Today is November 8th, 10 a.m. This is Matthew Cox's interview of Howard Talbot. We are in Cooperstown, New York, in Mr. Talbot's kitchen. And this is done for the Cooperstown Graduate Program. So, if you would just indulge me, could I have your full name, please?
My full name is Howard C. Talbot, Jr.
Were you named after your father?
I was.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Where were you born? Or where and when were you born?
Well, I was born on October 6, 1925, in the Pardee Hospital in New Berlin, New York.
And
I think that I was the first one from the town of Edmiston, village of Edmiston, to be born in a hospital. Everyone else of my generation that I can remember was born at home. But I think I was the only one born in this little hospital in New Berlin.
Well, that's certainly a little nice little claim to fame.
That's right.
Where is Edmiston in relation to Cooperstown?
Well, Edmiston is a small town that is located about 15 to 18 miles west of Cooperstown.
Okay.
It's a small town of only probably, well, when I was living there, I'm going to say around 800 to 900 people.
And so we already mentioned your father, but who is the rest of your family?
Well, I have my wife, Alice, of whom I've been married to for 60 years now. And we have three children. We have two daughters and a son. And our one daughter, Julie, was a vocal music teacher in Lauren Central School for 32 or 33 years. She is now retired. And she and her husband live in Morris. And then we have another daughter, Judy, who lives in Liverpool, north of Syracuse.
Okay.
And she is the supervisor of parks for Oneida Shore Park on Oneida Lake. And then we have a son who is living in St. Petersburg, Florida. And he's been down there now for about 5-6 years, I guess.
And do you have any brothers or sisters?
No. I had a sister, but she died at about 18 months old with, I believe it was spinal meningitis. In those days, they didn't have the drugs or the way to treat things of that nature that they have today. So she died about 18 at age about 18 months.
Okay. And how long did you stay in Edmiston?
Well, I stayed in Edmiston until I was probably about a sophomore in high school. Well, in fact, I lived there, but I went to school there till I was a sophomore. And then my mother and father sent me to the Manlius Military Academy in Manlius. And I was out there for 2 years, excuse me, but still living in Edmiston.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in service for 2.5 years during World War II. And when I came back, I still lived in Edmiston for a time till I met my wife and we were married and then we moved to Cooperstown.
Okay. And when did you go into the service? What year was that?
Oh, goodness, I'm not certain. It was probably about 1940, 1941.
Okay.
I'm really not certain of that date.
And where did you serve?
Pardon me?
Where did you serve?
Well, I served in the two outfits. I served in the, started out in the tank destroyers, and then I went from there to the armored field artillery. And I was sent from quite an experience I had actually when I was still in the tank destroyers. We were going over to the South Pacific, and they sent me on an advanced unit with the train of all of our equipment, the tanks and destroyers and so on, from Fort Hood, Texas to Seattle, Washington. And I had to ride on a flat car going over the Rocky Mountains. And that was quite an experience.
I bet.
Quite an experience.
My goodness.
And then I went from there, from Seattle, over to Hawaii, and we were going with the idea of joining the 10th Army. man being in on the invasion of Okinawa. But our ship had problems going to Hawaii, so we were late getting there, and they didn't wait for us. They went on. So we got there and took our jungle training, and then they didn't know what to do with us. But we spent most of our time either in Pearl Harbor loading or unloading ships for about 6 months. And then I was sent on LST from there to the Philippines, to Leyte, with the idea of being in on the invasion of Japan. But we never invaded Japan, so I really was very fortunate, never saw any action.
What was that like, kind of being on the edge of going into battle? I mean, were you tense? Were you relieved? What were your feelings?
Well, we never got close enough that I really had that any kind of a feeling. Okay. I just had in the back of my mind that eventually I probably would be in some kind of a battle. Mm-hmm. But it was never brought close enough to us so that we could feel or say now, like, well, next week we're going to be in on the invasion of Japan, or we're going to be doing this. And so I never really got to that point of coming close enough to going into battle to have any feeling of that nature, to be truthful.
Interesting. So he said, after the war you came home and mm-hmm. got married.
Yeah.
Where'd you meet your wife?
Well, her family moved into Edmundston right after World War II. They had been living down around the metropolitan area in New York. Okay. And my wife was still working in New York, but she came home to visit her parents. And they had an opening in New York Central for her type of work, and they offered her more money than she was getting in New York, so she stayed up here and went to work. And we both went to the same church, the First Baptist Church or Second Baptist Church of Edmundston. So I met her actually through church. That's how I met her.
Okay. And then what brought you to Cooperstown after you were married?
Well, I had been working over here for about a year and a half to 2 years before we were married at the Leatherstocking Corporation after I graduated from the School of Commerce in Utica. And so my job was here, and I had been driving back and forth, still living in Edmundston. Mm-hmm. But then after we were married, of course, my job was here, and so we looked for a place, and we couldn't find a place immediately, but we did find a place up on Pioneer where we could rent, and we did that from, I think, October until May, and then we found an apartment we moved into, and we bought another house on Walnut Street, lived there for a while, but our family started coming along, the house wasn't big enough, so then we moved up here where we're at, 95 Pioneer.
All right. And then what was the Leatherstocking Corporation?
Yeah, I worked for the Leatherstocking Corporation as an accountant.
Okay.
And that was the headquarters of all their accounting for all the things in Cooperstown, with the exception of Iroquois Farm. And some of my accounts that I had to work with was the gymnasium account, and also the Baseball Hall of Fame account, and the Cooper Inn and the Otisaga Hotel. In fact, one of the first jobs I had, first year I worked here, and twice a year, was to inventory everything in the Otisaga Hotel. Because in those days, in the wintertime, it was a girls' school, the Knox School mm-hmm. for Girls. And they closed the school out in June, and brought different furniture and so forth in, and it was a hotel during the summer. And then in September again, they'd take the hotel out, and in would come the girls.
Interesting.
So I had to inventory all of the beds and nightstands and chairs and tables and everything of that nature in it.
It sounds like a very long
project. It was. It took about, I guess, about 4 or 5 days to do it all.
Wow. And then, so with all these different experiences, what brought you to the National Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, as I say, I had the Hall of Fame accounting mm-hmm. Back in those days at Leatherstocking, because everything was done there.
Right.
Then they decided that they would take the accounts and move them to the respective places. In other words, not only the Hall of Fame, but they did the same thing with NESHA. All the accounting for New York State is historical was done there. And they moved all of that kind of in the Farmer Museum up to Neosho. Hmm. So they asked me if I would like to go with the account to the Hall of Fame and add other responsibilities to my job. And I said yes, because I love baseball. And that's how I got to go over to the Hall of Fame.
Okay. And then you say you love baseball. What teams did you root for? What teams do you still root for?
Well, my two teams that I've always kind of held dear to my heart, and so to speak, was the Boston Red Sox in the American League, and then the Philadelphia Phillies in the National League. But I didn't really show that very much while I was at the Hall of Fame, because we worked with all clubs, and we couldn't really show partiality to one over another.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to hold that in and not publicize it much while I was there working.
Yeah. How did you feel when the Phillies won the World Series a couple weeks ago?
This year.
Yeah, this year.
Yeah. Well, I think they were basically a better team than the Rays were. Although I've seen the Rays play a couple times this year because our son living in Florida, I've been down to visit him.
Right.
And we went to a game in the spring training. Excuse me. And then we went to a game also last September. So I've seen them play, and they were a good team, and no doubt about it. But they didn't have quite the experience and quite the method to go about winning the World Series that the Phillies did. And I was very pleased that they won.
So let's see. So you started off as an accountant. Mm-hmm. Moving from leather sacking to the Hall of Fame, and you said you added some responsibilities to that job. What did you do at the Hall of Fame?
Well, to begin with, not a lot more. They had a small gift shop, and I worked in the gift shop selling a few souvenirs. Okay. And I also was working somewhat with the exhibits, even to put the exhibits on display, because we didn't have. But only, I think, there were five of us there working at the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. Bob Quinn was the director, who was sitting at a desk out in the main part of the museum and just answering questions to the public. And he had a secretary. And then we had one girl who worked on admissions and in the gift shop, and a custodian, and myself. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of were a jack of all trades, master of none, you might say. And if somebody were sick, I'd take over and maybe sell the tickets and souvenirs and just pick things up as we could see what needed to be done. And that went on for several years. And then we built a new addition to the Hall of Fame. And, of course, that meant adding more help and we then had to hire somebody to do more work with exhibits, and so it's just kind of mushroomed from there on.
When was the new edition built?
1951 was the first edition.
Okay. did you have to do a lot of extra research or really do anything else to become more of an expert on baseball since...
Well, I didn't have to. I did that on my own. We had a fellow there by the name of Ernest Lanigan, who was the historian. And he had more baseball history in his head than are in any books there have ever been written about it. But we never could get him to sit down, as we are, and record all of the things that he knew.
Mm.
He was more interested, I think, really in the minor leagues. And he would pick minor league players up and follow them through their career until they became a major league player. Then he would drop them and go back and pick up more minor leaguers again.
Interesting.
That was just a little quirk that he had.
Yeah.
But he was an invaluable source to us for many, many years. And his cousin, I think, J.G. Taylor Spink, is the one who published the Sporting News.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
In 1939... I've read in a New York Times article that you were at the first Hall of Fame induction. Would you tell me a little bit about that? The first Hall of Fame ceremony in 1939.
Oh, in 39.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Well, first of all, they had games being played on Doubleday Field almost every day, at least two or three times a week, from early May right straight through into September, to help celebrate baseball's 100th anniversary. And one of the games that was played in the month of May was between Manlius Military Academy and Albany Academy. And at that time, I was going to Manlius and playing in the bands. So I came with the team and the band, and they had a parade down Main Street. So I was playing in the band for that back in May in 39. And when the June 12th ceremony was held, my father brought me over to it so I could see it. So I was lucky to be here on that particular day when they had the induction and opening of the Hall of Fame.
Were you able to see any of the players from where you were, or do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Of course, there was quite a crowd, and I was not as tall and as big as I am now, mm-hmm. so there were some things I did not see. Right. But I did see Ty Cobb coming in. He was late getting there, and he worked his way right straight through the crowd up to the platform, mm-hmm. climbed up over the platform and the railing to get on the platform for the ceremony. So I do remember that.
Yeah.
But I saw Babe Ruth and the others that were there for it, yes.
That's great. Being there for that ceremony, did that make you any more excited to be working for the Hall of Fame all those years later?
No, I don't think so, no. I mean, it was, in fact, when I first did their account, or when I moved over there in 51 permanently, it didn't even recall the fact that I had been here in 39,
really?
And it didn't register as a great thing of importance to me at that point.
Interesting. Why do you think that was?
I don't know. That meant a lot to me in 39, but of course quite a few years had gone by before I came over there to work permanently. And so it just didn't have that much of an impression on me to make me jump up with joy that I've been there in 39 and then going there to work permanently in 51. But through the years, yes, I have thought it's quite unusual that that would be the case as far as that's concerned.
So you started off kind of accounting, like you said, but then and doing a lot of other responsibilities. But what was your next step? What was your next position?
I think the next step was that Paul Kerr, who was then the president of the Hall of Fame, made me assistant treasurer. And so I did a little bit more of the accounting and so on that I had not been doing before. And that went on for a number of years. And then finally, that was made treasurer of the Hall of Fame. So then I was in complete charge of all the accounting for the museum. And would have to make up all reports and everything to the board of directors and so on. And then for the last 25 years, I was made director. And, of course, that meant that I was in charge of the entire operation. And something that I enjoyed immensely. And it gave me a chance to get really to know more about some of the Hall of Famers themselves personally.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a policy that I instigated after, a few years after I'd been in, that if a Hall of Famer died, it behooved us to go to their service, if services were held, to at least let the family know that how much their coming to Cooperstown every year for the induction ceremony meant to us by coming to the service for the Hall of Famer.
Did you ever get any feedback from the families that they appreciated
that? Oh, yes. Yes. And it was very well received.
Good.
I don't know whether it's still done today or not, but we always had a wonderful note or something from the family thanking us for that.
What made you decide to start that policy?
Well, I just felt it was a way that we could get closer to the Hall of Famer family themselves, because when the Hall of Famer himself died, that in a sense might terminate our association with that family. Mm. And we wanted to continue relationship with him. We were looking, too, for additional material to put on display, and that maybe would help us a little bit by furthering our relationships with the rest of the family. And I just felt it was a nice thing to do, too.
What year, I think you said, but what year did you become the director again?
Well, let's see, I retired in 93, and 25 years from that would be, 68? I'm not very good at math without a paper and pencil.
I believe so, yeah. So you retired in 90?
I ran 93.
Okay, and you were there
25 years prior to that, whatever that would be.
Yeah, I'm a history major.
What does that come out of?
I'm a history major, so I'm not very good with numbers either. But do you remember the process of how you were chosen to become the director? I mean, were there other candidates? Was it like a...
No, there really was no big deal. We had several directors. Bob Quinn was our first director, and he came from the Boston Braves. And basically, he was there, I think, maybe only like 2 or 3 years, because he was well along in years. And his main responsibility, as I said before, was to sit at a desk out in the museum yeah. proper and answer questions that fans coming in would ask of him. Mm-hmm. And then we had another one by the name of Sid Keener, who came from St. Louis. He worked for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And then he... was there, I've forgotten just how many years now, maybe about 10, 15 years before he died. And when he died, they named Ken Smith, who was a baseball reporter with the New York Daily Mirror. And the Mirror had just folded before we needed him. And so he was given the job of director. It was a job that... I think they kind of looked for someone like that to take it over who had been familiar with baseball mm-hmm. and yet did not at that point have a job. And they really were not paying a whole lot for salary for the director. The commissioner's office and the two leagues did help somewhat to start with. We got $5,000 each from the National American Leagues and the commissioner's office that were designed to pay the salary and expenses of the director. Mm-hmm. So there were $15,000 that we had to spend for a director, which wasn't much. Mm-hmm. And then Ken Smith actually retired, they talked about a director, and I had been there long enough, so I certainly had had enough experience. And so they just simply asked me to become director. Mm. There was no search made. So that's just how it happened.
Interesting. How do you feel that you kind of moved into that position when now it's probably such a competitive search?
Well, I was very pleased to be named director, and because I had been there long enough so that I could see avenues that we could improve ourselves. And one of the avenues that I felt quite strongly about was the fact that I would like to see us become accredited with the American Association of Museums. And so we started working on that, and we did have an inspection and found that there were several avenues where we were lacking, and that we were to shore up those avenues and then have another inspection to see if we could pass and be accredited. And that was never done or accomplished, really, before I retired. Mm-hmm. So I never did get museum accredited before I retired. But that was one of the things that I wanted to do.
When had you heard of, like, museum accreditation?
Well, we belonged to the American Association of Museums okay. and had for a number of years, and we're classified as an educational institution and qualified under the 501c3 rule, tax-wise. Mm-hmm. And I was just interested in it enough to pursue more information about the American Association Museum. And this was a part of their programs that they offered. And this is how I became apprised of it.
Okay. What about it when you were reading about accreditation? What did you see that made you want to achieve that?
Well, there was only one other Hall of Fame, which was the Hall of Fame of Great Americans in New York, prior to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I felt that we were really something special. We just weren't another hometown museum, so to speak.
Right.
And I wanted to do everything to bring us up to the top quality museum that we should be. And most all of the museums that are first-class museums are accredited by the American Association. And so I thought this would be one way to raise our level a little bit by becoming accredited.
When you were going through that inspection process and things, at that time, what were the strengths of the Hall of Fame?
What were the
strengths of the Hall of Fame?
The strengths?
Yeah.
Well, the strengths lied pretty much with the way in which we exhibited everything.
Okay.
And the operation, day-to-day operation that we had, and the amount of staff that we have for various responsibilities. One of the things that they did not like or felt we should improve upon was our educational part of it. Which we really, at that point in time, were not doing much with education other than having school groups come into the museum and take a tour through. And we would guide them through the museum, not just turn them loose. And that was the only educational portion that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, that has drastically improved and has gone to the point now that, well, I can't extemporate on it because I'm not there anymore, and I've been out for quite a few years. But it's by computers now. They can do so many wonderful things with classes, we'll say, in Atlanta, Georgia, right from Cooperstown.
The distance and learning.
So this is something that they're doing right now.
That's very good. What, as your time at director, you guys did a lot of great exhibits. What was one of your favorite objects or exhibits from your time at the Hall of Fame?
Well, that's a hard question.
Or was there something that just that you'd see that would just, you know, kind of make you go, wow, that is, you know, amazing or something like that?
Well, I think one of the ones that I can remember the most was the Ted Williams statue that we have. That was carved by an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he did several paintings of Ted before he did the actual sculpture itself. But it was a very realistic thing. Even the socks looked like wool socks. And the wrinkles in his hands looked very realistic. And it was all one piece of wood except for the bat. He had a bat in his hand over his shoulder, and the bat was a separate piece of wood. Everything else was all one piece.
Interesting.
And it was dedicated, and Mrs. Yawkey was here, and Ted was here for it, and it was on a Hall of Fame weekend, and that was the only time I ever saw Ted Williams break down and shed a tear.
Do you remember what year that was?
I don't, to be honest, no.
How many had you met Ted Williams previously?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any particular, like, vivid memories of Ted Williams, aside from the statue?
Well, Ted was, of course, an ardent fisherman. He, I know, practically every year for Hall of Fame weekend, he would be flying in from somewhere up in Alaska or some distant part where he'd gone fishing.
Interesting.
And he did love to fish a great deal. And one thing that always struck me with Ted, and this may be little bit on the other side of baseball, but he never wore a necktie. He'd go out to a big dinner. Everybody was in tuxedos. He would never wear a necktie.
Interesting.
And that was just Ted. That was his lifestyle.
Yeah.
But now I have wonderful memories of a lot of the Hall of Famers, actually, because they're, well, as being director, I got more close to them, corresponded with them more, and mm-hmm. talked to them on the phone, and saw more of them, and so on. So some of the things, for example, I can remember with Warren Spahn. First of all, when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, his brother, who worked for the railroad, lived in Rochester, came down for the ceremony. And he was, of course, sitting with the family up front. Mm-hmm. And the ceremonies then were held in Cooper Park in front of the library building. And when it came time for Warren's speech and to be inducted, it affected his brother so that he had a heart attack. And we had a doctor there, Dr. Pollock, actually, in those days, to keep a track of the crowds and so on. And he was there and attended to him and, of course, got an ambulance and took him right up to the hospital, which is just up the street. Uh-huh. So that was the first thing about Warren. And then I can remember one year I was coming back to the ceremonies with his son Greg and his wife, and Warren had a girlfriend with him, and he called ahead of time and said, you know what I'd like to do? I want to come in 2 or 3 days early, and I'd like to go sailing on the lake. He said, can you arrange it? And I said, certainly. So I arranged for sailboats for them. And the day came, I took them up to Thayer's to get the sailboats. And, well, he asked, he said, do you know how to sail? And they said, oh, yeah, we know how. So, pardon me, Warren got in his sailboat with his girlfriend. And they were just a little breed, nothing too strong. Mm-hmm. And they were all set, pushed away from the dock. So they pushed away from the dock. And they had gone maybe 25, 30 feet out into the water, and all of a sudden, over they went. A gust came up, and he tipped over, and they both got soaking wet. They were going to a party that night, so I had to take his girlfriend down to a hairdresser to get her hair fixed and ready to go out that night. And I never let him forget it. His son and his wife went off in beautiful shape. And Warren stayed, and he got out and did some sailing himself, finally.
Do you have any other, particular players or stories?
I felt I was fairly close to Tom Seaver. In fact, Tom and I were both on a foundation board for the Little League Museum for a number of years. So I got to know Tom that way probably just as much as I did through the Hall of Fame. Hmm. But it was one year, I've forgotten just year, that he and Nancy were stayed over on Tuesday from Hall of Fame weekend. And we're going back to Wendy. And we, my wife and my one daughter, Judy, and her roommate went over to the Osaga for dinner. And afterward, we walked out on the porch, and here sat Tom and Nancy having their dinner. And so we stopped and talked for them a few moments, and something was said about our going home and playing bridge, because our daughter, Judy, and her friend played bridge. And he said, oh, bridge? He said, I haven't played bridge since I played for Chicago. And I said, well, come up and play. So he did. Nancy stayed down to pack to get ready because they were leaving the next mm-hmm. morning. But Tom came up and played bridge with us for a couple of hours that night. So they're human beings. They're right down to earth.
Yeah.
I know lots of kids worship Hall of Famers and ball players, which is fine. But when you get to know them, they're just like anybody else.
That's great.
So those are some of the experiences that I've had.
Yeah. Do you remember any particular baseball event? Some particular thing that happened within the game affecting you more because you were working for the Hall of Fame and you did know these a lot of the players and a lot of the Hall of Famers as people?
I don't think so. I'm not a hero worshiper, first of all. Never have been. And anybody, I don't care who they are, whatever they do in baseball, they're still a human being. And I don't get too excited over things that occur like that. So I can't really think of anything now that stands out head and shoulders above other incidences that have gone on.
Interesting.
So I just can't think of any.
That's, yeah, because a lot of baseball fans have that, you know, they know where they were.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting. So, let's see here. Did you feel, knowing these people, or knowing the Hall of Famers, you know, as people, though, and not doing the hero worship, did you feel maybe a special connection to baseball or something? Did you feel about it, do you think, differently than your average fan?
Well, I don't know. I always felt that I was very fortunate to be in the position that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And that I had been asked to do this. I didn't apply for the job, and that always gave me a little satisfaction knowing that. But I guess my feeling was that I'm very fortunate, very lucky to be where I am, doing what I'm doing. And that was the way I looked at it, okay. I think.
What was the relationship? I know you talked about salary, but other than that, what was some of the relationship between Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame? How did you interact?
Well, years ago, it was wonderful. We had a very good relationship with the league offices and the commissioner's office. I think the closest we were with them was when Bowie Kuhn was commissioner, and Joe Cronin was president of the American League, and Chubb Feeney, president of the National League. I think during those years, we were the closest to them. And not only just in talk, but they were also the commissioner and the two presidents were on our board of directors. And we've always had Major League Baseball represented on our board. And now they even have members of the Hall of Fame on the board. But you see, things have changed, so there is no longer really the feelings that there used to be between the leagues. There's no American League president. There's no National League president. They call it the American League and the National League, but it's all run through the commissioner's office. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same as it used to be, although I'm not involved, so I can't elaborate on that much. But if we needed something done or we had some idea, maybe we would pass it by the commissioner and by the league presidents, and generally they would go along with us.
Like what type of ideas? What type of things?
Well, ideas doing policy, more or less, I will say, with the method of electing members, whether it be by the baseball writers or the Committee on Veterans. Mm-hmm. I think that was the area that was most prevalent with them, as far as that goes. Yeah.
Did you have a vote in the
election? No, I did not.
Okay.
No. Of course, the baseball writers
right.
Vote on the active, what we call active players. Mm-hmm. And the Hall of Fame Committee on Veterans was a select group that was picked. There were certain writers, there were certain baseball commissioners on it, and the league presidents, mm-hmm. and Hall of Famers themselves, and so it was a select committee. But no, I did not have any vote.
How does a player go from being elected on the normal Hall of Fame ballot to the veteran? Like, can you explain the Veterans Committee and that sort
well,
of thing?
Well, the baseball writers would vote on what we call, I shouldn't say active, but the modern day players, because they had to be retired for at least 5 years before they became eligible.
Okay.
And they would be voting upon those players that had completed at least 10 years in the Major League service, mm-hmm. but been retired for 5 years. And the Veterans Committee was able to vote on players that maybe had been missed way back in the early 20s or early 1900s. And they could also vote on some who had been missed by the writers that they didn't feel it warranted election, so the Veterans Committee could reconsider them. And they also were able to vote on baseball executives and managers and umpires, okay. which the writers could not do.
Interesting.
That's the main difference.
Okay. All right. Do you think that, being that you were at the first induction ceremony and you've probably seen, countless ceremonies over your time, and I know do you still attend the induction ceremonies?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that they have grown in popularity, or when if they haven't, when was their kind of their heyday?
No, it used to be that originally the ceremonies were held right on Main Street at the front entrance of the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And then it got to be so many people coming that there wasn't room enough so they could see because they were up the street too. They had to close off the street. So we moved it out and back of what was the leather stocking office 1 year. And then we built the library building and we had it in front of the library. Mm-hmm. And the year that Brooks Robinson was elected, we had a big crowd from Baltimore. And that was really the start of thinking we've got to have more room. So it was decided that we would move down to the Clark Sports Center, where we had this huge field that would hold probably 100,000 people if need be. And so that was the start of the big crowds. And I think the biggest crowd we had was when Cal Ripken went in. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. And there'll be years when I think a normal year right now, the way things are going, should average 15,000 to 20,000. Mm-hmm. And I doubt the day will come in my lifetime when we'll ever have 75,000 or 80,000 again. I don't see anyone in the future that's of that stature that would draw that many mm-hmm. people.
Yeah. It's those Baltimore fans.
That's right.
Do you remember any particularly, any speeches or any incidents from those ceremonies that really stuck with you? Anybody being particularly eloquent or not?
No, to be honest with you, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think years ago, I will say that some of the people like, Harry Heilman, for example, who, I'm sorry, not Harry Heilman, because he was dead when he was elected, right. But his wife got up and spoke for him, accepted a plaque on his behalf. And she did a marvelous job for a widow accepting for mm-hmm. her husband. But most of the ones that back in those days that accepted their plaque were at the microphone about 2 minutes, and that was it. And there are some that had a speech written on paper that would get up and they'd get the paper in front of them, and then it affected them so that they couldn't even read the paper. And they said, "I'm sorry, I thank you," and sat down. Hmm. And that has happened. Today, it's people are more prepared for this, and they have a prepared speech. Mm-hmm. And I will admit, some of them talk too long. I mean, we like to give them, I think, about 15 minutes, but some stretch it into 20 or 25. But when you got 4 or 5 and going in, that's make quite a long ceremony.
Did anybody in particular go 20 or 25 minutes?
Oh, there's probably quite a few of them.
Okay.
Quite a few.
Interesting. Yeah. Why do you think they went from being microphone shy to...
Well, I think this day and age, people are more adept at appearing at places and making public speeches for organizations and schools and so on, or television, so that they're better prepared to give a speech. And some of them write their own, and some of them have it written by someone else for it. But it's their one claim to fame, and they all indicate and seem to say that this is the pinnacle of their career. They've enjoyed playing, they've had a wonderful career on the field, but this is the ultimate. And they have attained this goal, and they just want to take advantage of it, I think. That's it.
How'd that make you feel about your job as director, knowing that these... How did it make you feel about your job as director, knowing that these men valued their Hall of Fame spot so much?
Well, it made me feel very good, to be truthful. Mm-hmm. They had some wonderful experiences on the field and off during their career. But this was the thing that they considered the top. There was nothing beyond this that they could ever expect. And so it made me feel very good.
Was there
knowing that they had that feeling toward us.
Yeah. Was there ever any pressure, though, knowing that becoming a Hall of Famer would change their life so much? Was there ever any pressure or any... Although I know you didn't have a vote. I mean, was there ever anything like worrying about a guy being on the ballot and not making it or anything like that?
Not that part of it, no. It didn't used to be years ago when I first went in or worked there that their becoming elected meant that much. I mean, they weren't asked to appear here and appear there. But now they're asked to do many things. And so I think most of them realize that there is a responsibility that goes along with it, that they are representing the Hall of Fame at whatever function they may be attending, and that they do have this responsibility to keep their standards high.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any controversies at the Hall of Fame, such as the kind of a modern examples like the Barry Bonds home run ball? I know that caused a lot of commotion. Was there ever anything like that in your time?
Not while I was there, no. We never had anything that caused that much disturbance, you might say. The drug situation is something now that's very prevalent, and that is going to come into play very soon with people who are going to become eligible. And we had discussed this at quite length, and we just didn't come up with what we thought was the right answer. So what we did, we made a ruling that no one would be eligible for membership if they were not on baseball's active list. And some of these people who have been on drugs or had other problems are not on the active list, and they're not able to attend ball games or be on the field or participate in any baseball functions.
Mm-hmm.
So if baseball puts them on an active list, then they become eligible to be voted on.
Okay.
But if they're on the inactive list, they are not eligible to be voted on.
And the active list is what exactly? I mean, that says... That
anybody who might be banned from baseball... Like Pete Rose, for example.
Okay.
He's on the inactive list. He can buy a ticket and go to a ball game, but he can't go on the field.
Okay.
And he cannot participate in baseball functions,
mm-hmm.
This type of thing. Now, that's the example right there.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, how do you feel about the Pete Rose situation? I know recently, he always seems to be trying to get back on that active list, and... how do you feel about him?
Well, my personal feeling is that he does not belong on the active list. He did something which was wrong in the game of baseball, and he denied it up and down to start with, and finally he's admitted it. And We do have, or I say do, we did have at least anyway, a sizable exhibit mm-hmm. telling of Pete Rose's accomplishments on the field. But that does not mean that he is a member of the Hall of Fame, because we look at it, really it's two different things. There's the Baseball Museum, which tells the history of our national game. And there's the Hall of Fame, where we honor the all-time greats of the game. So there's two different things there. And we did show in the museum portion what he accomplished on the field, but he's not a member. Kids look up to these people as their heroes. And if they said, well, Pete Rose can do this and gamble all this money and so on, so can I. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that to happen.
Yeah. How do you feel about, do you think it is the role of the museum to explain some of those not-so-great moments, such as the betting and steroids and things like that?
Should we have exhibits on that?
Yeah, do you think it's part of the
game? So that's a part of the game. That's mm-hmm. part of baseball. Okay. And we're telling the history of baseball. We're not trying to cover it up. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, we're not advocating that we're promoting it either.
Right.
But it is a portion of the game, and we've got to show it as best we can.
How do you feel about the coming up? Like you said, some of these players are going to have allegations against them, not a lot of proof, but you know, the rumor of steroids hanging over them. How should the museum deal with that, or what do you think would happen to them when they get to committees for voting in?
That's as I said before, if they're on baseball's active list, mm-hmm. they are eligible to be voted on. Okay. If the baseball has taken them off the list, they can't be voted on. Be the same thing with drugs or gambling or whatever the problem might be.
Going back to, you know, I mentioned like the Barry Bonds home run ball, because that's kind of the controversy that I have really grown up with. How would you have dealt with that situation? There was a lot of heat, you know, for the Hall of Fame taking it with the asterisk stamped on there. What would you have done?
I don't think the asterisk should be on it. I'm glad we got the ball, let's mm-hmm. put it this way.
Yeah.
But I don't think that an asterisk would deserve, really. He hit them regardless. And so it should be without the asterisk. That's my feeling.
So during your 25 years as president and trying to get accredited and all these other things, what do you think was one of the areas that the Hall of Fame made the largest improvement? You know, what do you think that you enacted that was just a really great thing?
Well, I think from the year one up to the present time, I think the biggest advancement the Hall of Fame made, or best decisions that were made, mm-hmm. were working with the educational program. I'm not in favor of sending a lot of material around the country. Some of this is irreplaceable. And I know they've had this exhibit that was well received throughout the whole country, but I'm not an advocate of doing that. And there are other ways, I think, that we can apprise the public of the history of baseball through television and computers mm-hmm. and things that I'm not familiar with. That, in fact, was one of the reasons I retired. We were going very heavily into computers.
Okay.
And they sent me to Atlanta, Georgia, to learn about CD-ROM. And I was down there for 2 days, and I came home, and I didn't know what was said. And that was the beginning of my thinking to retire. Because mm-hmm. I hate computers, so that's just me.
You said, you know, you didn't have very much education when you started as president. Was there a particular program that you remember that got enacted, or that you created, or that was created by your staff that you were proud of?
Well, I think the educational program was started with Bill Guilfoyle, okay. who was our PR director for many years. He is probably the main reason that we got it started with the educational program. Mm-hmm. And we would bring school groups into the museum and would take them around, and then we'd give them a quiz afterwards on what they saw. Or we might have a treasure hunt and have them take a piece of paper and go through the museum and find this ball or that bat or whatever that was described on the treasure hunt. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, you know, I find interesting is you started off as an accountant and these things. When you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up? And did you have any, you know, idea that this might be where you would be all these years later?
I had no idea I'd ever wind up in Cooperstown or at the Hall. My father was in the feed business, selling feed to farmers. And I had always wanted to go in business with him. But unfortunately, I had an asthmatic condition when in my youth that did not allow me to be around feed dust or I would be in misery. So I had to give that up. And even after I graduated from School of Commerce in Utica, I really didn't have much of an idea. The first thing I thought of was going down to Endicott and apply for a job with IBM as a salesman or working with them. And I did that. But it was right after the war, and they were having difficulty getting materials to manufacture more typewriters and whatever at that point. And they said, go home, get a job, and if there's an opening, we'll call you. Well, I went home, but I never got the call. But they had seen in the Leather Stocking Corporation here in the paper where I graduated, and they were in need of an accountant. So they called me over for an interview, and that was how I got started there. Yeah. But I had no idea I'd ever wind up at the Hall of Fame. Even when I went to work for Leather Stocking, no idea that I would be over there.
Yeah. Certainly an interesting turn. You mentioned that this is kind of going to be a little side thing from our baseball talk, but it really does interest me, is you mentioned you had asthma growing up and that it was the feed really upset it. What did, were there any treatments at this time to help you deal with that?
Well, I think it was for my 16th birthday that my mother and father took me to New York at a doctor's suggestion to some specialist to test for asthmatic condition and what caused it. And I know they stuck needles in both arms every day for 3 or 4 days, and then I'd have to go back and they'd see if there was any reaction and so on. And they did find a few things. Feed dust was one of them. Ragweed was another, some weeds and so on. And by the way, as a sidebar to that one, we were down in New York for that on my birthday. My dad was able to get tickets to take me to Ebbets Field. That was my first Major League Baseball
game. Oh, wow.
That was my 16th birthday.
That's a great 16th birthday.
So I came back, and they did give me a serum to take a shot, I think, once a week, which I did for a period of time. And then this doctor that we had over in Edmiston said that, you know, there's a camp over on Otsego Lake in Cooperstown, and it might be well for him to go over there for a summer and see if he's free from this asthma. So my mother and father sent me over here, Camp Shenango, and sure enough, I was free from it as could be. Never had a better problem. And as a result, I kept coming back as a camper until I got old enough to become a junior counselor and then as a counselor. So I kept coming back over here till I went into service in World War II.
And where, kind of in relation to where we are now, where was Camp Shenango?
It was on the east side of the lake,
okay,
going up beyond Kingfisher Tower. Mm-hmm. And there used to be a Boy and Girl Scout camp just beyond that, and it was about a quarter of a mile beyond there. It was between the road and the lake. And when I started over here, it was just a dirt road. And now, of course, it's paved and quite heavily.
Yeah. What made this asthma camp special? Was it the location, or did you do particular activities?
Well, I liked it to begin with, the whole program. They had good meals, they had good staff, good counselors, good program. They had horseback riding, a lot of water sports. I love to swim, and I just love it over there, and that's one of the reasons that I kept coming back. And, of course, I was free from asthma, but when I went in service in World War II, from that point on, I never had another attack of asthma.
Interesting. So, do you think that your time as a camp counselor maybe played an influence in how you ran the Hall of Fame as its director?
Could very well be. I never looked at it in that light, but by the fact that I was in charge of kids in a tent, mm-hmm. five kids in a tent, might have had a bearing on it, yes. Could very well be.
Yeah, just kind of curious with you talking about the education being so important. Mm-hmm. And I was a camp counselor myself, and I know that that's a very educational role.
I love camping to begin with.
Okay.
So I think that's the main reason. Yeah. But no, that could very well be the case.
Interesting. And then so you bring up this 16th birthday, you were at Ebbets Field, which is amazing. Do you have any particularly vivid memories
from that? I don't, to be honest with you.
Do you remember who played or anything?
No, I don't. I don't even know who they played that day.
lost in time, I guess.
Right.
But I guess, you know, is there, I just kind of, you know, is there any particular story that we're missing from this, from your time at the Hall of Fame? Anything that you just...
To do with the Hall of Fame?
Well, yeah, I mean, just as your time as an accountant, just in your entire time there.
Well, there have been a lot of incidents that have happened. I think probably one of the most vivid is the fact that security is something that we learn by experience. Hmm. For example, we had Joe DiMaggio's locker, and the locker was sitting right out open, and in it was hanging his uniform, and his cap was up on the shelf. And we came to work one morning and went around looking, and here was the cap missing. And it just had laid on the shelf, and somebody had come along, found it, and picked it up, put it in the pocket, and walked out with it. So we said, well, we got to change that. So we wired the cap to the shelf, another cap. And the next thing, that was gone, because they had clipped the wire and walked off with it. So what we did, the next thing was to put a door on the front of the cabinet or the locker so that they could see through, but they couldn't reach in. And that worked pretty good for a while. And then one day we were cleaning the locker and so on. We happened to notice that the sleeve of the uniform had a hole about this big around. And somebody had gotten a hold of it, pulled it through the little hole in the locker, and had a knife or shears and cut it off to take this piece of cloth home. So then we had to put plastic on the inside of the locker. So all these things we learned the hard way, so to speak.
Did you ever find any luck tracking down those caps or anything?
No.
No?
No. And another experience we had during the winter, I was over in the, in fact, most of us were over in the library for mm-hmm. a meeting, and the only one left over there was a girl on the ticket counter. And the phone rang in the library, and it was a woman on the ticket counter saying, "Howard, come over here. We've got a deer in here." And I said, "What? Come over quick." Well, what had happened? A deer had come up Main Street and had turned into the entrance of the Hall of Fame and had jumped up over the railing. And it couldn't stop in time on the width of the porch until mm-hmm. it hit this window. It was a small window pane and a metal window. And it broke the glass, and his nose went right through the window into the ticket counter. And scared the daylights girl that was on the duty there. And then it jumped over a railing on the other side of the porch and between the building next to us and was caught in, because there was a fence on both ends. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get out. So we finally called for the SPCA to come to tranquilize it so we could get it out. But in the meantime, before they came, the deer managed to get underneath the barricade in the back and went on up through Cooper Park and out toward the hospital. So that was another experience.
That's crazy. My goodness. You know, now that there is Dreams Park and the distance learning, and, you know, information travels so much faster. When you were president, or I'm sorry, director, was the Hall of Fame still, or was it then as large of an attraction as it is now?
Well, I think, yes, it was. In fact, we had more people visit the Hall of Fame when I was there than we are today.
Oh, okay.
For our 50th anniversary, that would have been 89, we had over 500,000 people through. And it was astronomical because the majority of them came during the summer months. Mm-hmm. And we've not had that since. And so I think it was as popular by more people visiting. Of course, mm-hmm. now we've got the price of gas has gone up, travel restrictions and things that probably prohibit some people from coming. Mm-hmm. And this is one reason why the things they're doing to promote it by other means, by TV and so on, mm-hmm. Is great to keep us in front of the public.
You know, this is one thing I've always been curious about is not being from it myself. I've heard of Cooperstown, though, you know, my entire life. And what is it like growing up in this area, knowing about, you know, the village of Cooperstown, but also knowing that you could go anywhere in the world, almost anywhere in the world, and say Cooperstown, and people know.
Yeah.
What is it like growing up around here, or living around here?
Well, it's great. We've lived here, as I say, for 60 years. And it's not just the fact that the Baseball Hall of Fame is here, but it's what Cooperstown has to offer. Mm-hmm. You've got a wonderful hospital here. We've got the Otisauga Hotel. And you've got the golf course. You have the lake. You have the Clark Sports Center. Mm-hmm. You got the Glimmer Glass Opera. And you got a summer theater. And what more could you ask for? People, when I retired, people said, all right, where are you going? Are you going to Florida? Are you going to Arizona? Or where are you going to move to? I said, I'm not moving anywhere. I'm staying right here. The only thing that some people feel we lack is shopping. They don't have a place to buy clothes mm-hmm. or things of this nature. They have to go to Utica or Albany, Syracuse, Oneonta, somewhere. But that doesn't bother me because I'm not a shopper.
Yeah.
And but there's so much going for Cooperstown, a town of 22 or 300 people, mm-hmm. that it's just an ideal spot. Plus the fact you do have the museums.
Yes.
I mean, that is a big drawing card. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is really due in many, many ways to what the Clark family has done to Cooperstown. The things that they've seen happen here and have provided for. And keeping the lake as it is, for example, on the east side, there's no camps much allowed up through there except a few that they own. And I believe when the Clarks are all gone, that this will continue through foundations, too. But if it weren't for the Clarks, probably the Hall of Fame wouldn't be here, and Nisha wouldn't be here, mm-hmm. Farmer Museum, Hospital. All these things are as a result of what the Clarks have done. Mm-hmm. They furnished the village with the first fire truck.
Oh, really?
And they put in the first water system.
Do you remember the dates for either of
those? I don't.
No? Interesting.
So it's a very unusual situation. And fortunately, Jane Clark, who is the only surviving member now, taking a great deal of interest in Cooperstown. Mm-hmm. And she is continuing a lot of the things that her family has started, and we're very fortunate to have her feel the way she does.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I just want to say thank you very much for your time. And is there just one, you know, anything that we're forgetting? Anything that you want to add to the record?
No, not that I know of. I think we've covered the waterfront, so to speak.
All right.